Your favorite Voice America Talk Radio Network shows and hosts are in your car, outdoors, and wherever you need them to be.
Listen anywhere.
Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
The following program is being brought to you on the Seventh Wave Network. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit SeventhWaveNetwork.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit VoiceAmerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management. Welcome to Awakening to Conscious Co-Creation with your host, Peter Tung. This program will provide the groundwork you need to advance your awareness and be involved in the approaching transformation in consciousness. Now, your host, Peter Tung.
Hello and welcome to Awakening to Conscious Co-Creation. I'm your host, Peter Tung. Thank you for joining us today. The intention in these episodes is to give you insights into how the planet is shifting in frequency and vibration to a new level of awareness and how you can be part of this grand awakening. And talking about shifting in frequency and vibration, we're just in the beginnings of Mercury retrograde in the last couple of days, and we've been experiencing some of that just now. But I'm absolutely delighted that we've managed to hook up with Brian Forster, who is in Lima, Peru. Brian, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Peter.
And you've had a really interesting journey, and I'd love to hear you start off talking a bit about where you began, which actually was in my part of the world, connected with the Haida peoples of the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, I grew up on the west coast of Canada, and at about the age of 8 or 9, I became quite fascinated with Native art and oral traditions, mainly because I guess at that time in anyone's life, you're starting to question, you know, your origins and your sense of reality. So I simply thought that the people to question about the area in which I was living would be the Native people, since they have been living there for at least 10,000 years, whereas those of us who are immigrants, to the North American continent, our family lines might go back a generation or a few generations, but not enough to have a complete grasp of, you know, the environment and the history and that sort of thing of that part of the world.
And you've obviously been on a really interesting journey moving around some in significant places. So what would you say was the greatest insight you gathered from the Haida peoples?
Well, I think it's mainly from the oral traditions, the storytelling. What was, I guess, most profound was the fact that in all of the legend, you know, so-called legends, they speak of humanity or humans being on exactly the same level as all other creatures and plants or all other forms of creation. So it's not as though there's a hierarchy as there is in you know, the stories that I heard as a child coming, you know, perhaps from England, like Peter Rabbit or, you know, like, you know, Winnie the Pooh and things, where it's like animals dressed up in clothing and being anthropomorphic characters.
Yeah, right.
You know, basically being made fun of. Here it's like, you know, Raven has the same level or even superior level of intellect to that of a human being. And I just found that very, you know, very intriguing that, you know, all life forms were and are treated as if they're completely equal.
Yeah, absolutely. And then from there you moved to Maui in Hawaii.
Yeah, that started more or less as a childhood thing again, because my parents would, you know, go to Maui or, you know, one of the other Hawaiian islands for usually 2 weeks of the year, basically to get away from us, the children. but, you know, of course the stories of, you know, the volcanoes and, you know, the beautiful blue warm water and things. So I pestered my parents enough that by the age of 12, they took my brother and I, and I was automatically entranced by, again, Hawaiian oral traditions and things like that. And it took until I was, when I was 35, I moved there and spent 2 years assisting in building a 62-foot-long double-hull sailing voyaging canoe.
Wow. So shifted from carving totem poles to working with the boats.
Exactly. And it actually was a very major notch up in terms of craftsmanship, because we were, you know, we were building this canoe completely, you know, not like a dugout. It was more or less, I wouldn't say high tech, but more of a European style, what's called cold molding, where it's multiple laminations of thin layers of wood and fiberglass and carbon fiber and things. So it's, you know, very, very modern boat building that took, you know, a major learning curve in terms of my technical abilities in order to achieve it.
And again, additional insights and knowledge from the people of Maui, the Hawaiian culture. What came to you about living there and being part of that?
Well, what was fortunate for me was the fact that because I was involved in a Hawaiian cultural project, I became, you know, quite rapidly adopted by a number of people, and especially the old Hawaiian aunties. You know, any Hawaiian female elder is called an auntie, and so especially Auntie Pua, who is descended from, you know, Hawaiian royalty. She adopted me. You know,
oh, beautiful.
Basically, it's called being hanai'd, which means that you become part of the family, even though genetically you're not part of it. And just through spending time with her, you know, and her storytelling, she just taught me a number of different insights into the history of the Hawaiian people, which, as far as I can tell, has not been written down in books. You know, just fascinating in terms of their possible origins in Tahiti. And the stories get even more fascinating because some of the Hawaiian elders and other people told me that it was actually the Hawaiians that were the original, you know, so-called Polynesians, and that they were the ones who, you know, went to Tahiti and started the Tahitian culture. So it'll, you know, the deeper you go, the farther it goes back in time, even to you know, echoes of this, of the lost continent of Mu, which some of the Hawaiian elders very strongly believe, you know, existed 12 to, you know, 20,000 years ago.
So this is actually part of my questioning here was taking you from the Haida to Maui, then to Peru, and I was actually going to ask you later on, was that whole journey of yours connected to the lost civilization of Mu actually?
Well, it's that's a very good question, because in fact, subconsciously, I guess that's what I've been doing. It hasn't been a conscious search for the origins or the possible existence of Mu, because that, to me, for, you know, to a great extent, is you know, quite fictitious. But the more that I've been researching on the fringes of the Pacific Ocean and deep in the, you know, areas of Polynesia, the more this concept of this ancient, you know, culture and continent keep coming back and back. And that is part of what I'm investigating in Peru now, is this Pacific-wide connection of people, and the one thing which is a characteristic of that are this group of people, you know, called the Viracochans by some, who were these very tall, light-skinned, and reddish, rusty-haired, colored people who seem to have been, you know, one of the oldest cultures, at least in the Pacific Ocean area, pre-Polynesian, pre-Inca, etc.
Well, so I know nothing about them. So just fill us in a bit more on the Viracochans.
Well, the basic story is that the name or the word Viracocha refers to the creator. So with the Inca, for example, their creator deity was called Viracocha. Some people refer to Inti, which is the sun, as being the creator. But what, you know, if you do enough research, what you find out is that the sun, or Inti, which is the Quechua word for the sun, is the physical manifestation of the creator, and the creator essence or spirit was Viracocha. In the distant past, these people appeared who were called or named the Viracochans, as in the representatives of the creator. and they're commonly described as being, you know, tall in stature, light colored in skin, and again, rusty kind of red hair, sometimes even blondish hair. The problem is that that has been smacking of racism to some Native people, because they then automatically accuse European researchers such as myself, or European descendants, as stating that their cultures were, you know, begun by Europeans. And I'm not saying that whatsoever. What I'm saying is that the ancient Spanish chronicles state that these people were light-colored in skin, but we have no idea where they came from.
And what sort of area are we talking about that they apparently came from?
Well, we don't actually know where they came from, because oral traditions, as you probably know, tend to be very poetic in nature. For example, with the Inca, it's said that the first Inca either descended from the skies or rose from the waters of Lake Titicaca, and that, of course, is a poetic kind of statement, meaning that they came from the area of Lake Titicaca. But the thing is that these Viracochan people show up in different parts of the Pacific, including New Zealand, Aotearoa, or at least the descendants did, and also in Hawaii. So, and of course, Rapa Nui or Easter Island, that's where the so-called long-eared people are spoken of. So it seems to be the same people in general, or the same people specifically, visited and were teachers in all of these different parts of the Pacific Ocean.
Isn't that interesting? So Easter Island and New Zealand then must be on your shopping list of places to go and live, or be, at least spend some time.
Exactly. They're number one and number two.
the
others are... Oh, yeah, exactly. Well, the fascinating thing about Easter Island, for example, is, of course, the Moai, which are the great stone statues. Dr. Robert Schock, if you've heard of him, he's done a lot of work with in Egypt in terms of aging determining the actual age of the Sphinx, etc. And he was on Easter Island, or Rapa Nui, I think about 2 years ago, and he found two distinguishing features about these Moai, these big, the big stone heads. One is that the oldest ones are made of basalt, which is a very hard stone, and the more recent ones, of which there are a much greater number, are made out of a softer volcanic tuff. So it seems that the older ones, the basalt ones, were made by one culture, and then the softer stone ones were made by another, or by a following culture. And that's where you get into the concept of the long-eared people as compared to the short-eared people.
Wow. Well, it's going to be really interesting to follow your journey, as I think it looks like you may well be rediscovering Mu and the different constituents of that. That's fascinating.
Well, it seems like it, and actually logically, the most logical place that Mu could still exist would be Hawaii, because while I was living there, we found out by looking at topographical maps that during the Ice Age, the ocean level was... So during the last Ice Age, Maui, Molokai, Lanai, and Koho'olawe, which are now separate islands, would have been a single landmass. That doesn't make it a continent, but that makes it a very large landmass, very much in the middle of the Pacific, a very strategic point if you're a seafarer, because that would be a great place to stop in order to replenish supplies such as water and food.
Very interesting stuff, Brian. I'm really going to be fascinated to follow your journey as Mu rediscovers you and you rediscover it. We're going to our first break now, and we'll be back with Brian Forster talking about Peru and eventually talking about the elongated skulls. This is Peter Tung for Awakening to Conscious Co-Creation.
Stay connected. Sign up for our newsletter. Go beyond your favorite Voice America shows. Visit iradioblog.com.
Do you want to reach your highest potential in your personal and business life? Come and join our heart-centered community with Peter Tung and Sherry Chase. Embrace love, abundance, integrity, and personal empowerment in a safe and sacred space for your awakening. Our intention is to lay the groundwork for you, to advance your awareness efficiently, to be fully involved in the conscious co-creation of peace and prosperity on our beautiful planet. Go to myheartcenteredjourney.com for more information.
If you hear a dog barking or an angel singing, then you know that you are listening to Waking Up in America. Heard every Wednesday at 3 Pacific Time, Valerie Kirkhard and all of her friends will bring you powerful and humorous discussions that raise thoughts and give you insight on how to live your life to its fullest potential. Adventure is always a must on Waking Up in America with Valerie Kirkhard, every Wednesday at 3 Pacific.
Awakened Media for a transforming world. Seventh Wave Network.
You're listening to Awakening to Conscious Co-Creation with Peter Tong. If you have a question for Peter or comment on this series, please send an email to descendingdove@gmail.com. That's descendingdove@gmail.com. Now back to our program.
Welcome back to Awakening to Conscious Co-Creation with your host, Peter Tong. Please do check out my website, www.petertong.com. and also www.myheartcenteredjourney.com, where our Ambassadors of Light program is really flourishing, with people tuning in to our call every couple of weeks to let us all know what's going on in the world, which is pretty significant at the moment. But I have with me today Brian Forster, who is joining us from Lima, Peru. And Brian, after that first fascinating section, let's now talk about Peru, because you chose to move there from Maui at some point in your illustrious career.
Well, actually, I moved back to Canada, U.S., where I lived for 2 years, and then I moved back to Canada. But it was my fascination with, the oral traditions of Native people and, the history that drew me from there to basically Peru to initially study the Inca, but since then, all of the studying and work I've been doing in Hawaii and visiting Tahiti and even the west coast of Canada, it's all started to coalesce into one big topic, which seems to be the lost continent of Mu. But
so you've written a book on the brief history of the Incas. So just tell us about some of the key elements in that.
Sure. Well, basically the thing is that upon visiting Cusco, which of course was the capital of the Inca, I was having a very difficult time trying to find a nice small book talked about Inca history. That was in English. Most of the books in Cusco are in Spanish, even though there are so many English-speaking tourists who visit there. So my girlfriend at the time, who is now my wife, who is Peruvian, said, well, why don't you write a book? So that's exactly what I did, and that was my very first book, which is now in its second edition. And since then, I've written three other books directly relating to the Inca culture.
And what are the key elements that is important for our listeners to understand about the Inca and the Inca culture?
Well, I guess the most important thing is that, unfortunately, a number of the tour guides in Cusco are not as well informed as one would think. Especially when it comes to things like the megalithic structures there, which have been the object of curiosity for 500 years. What we now know is that the Inca didn't build the majority of the megalithic structures. They come from a much older culture. But most of the tour guides in Cusco will tell you that the Inca built everything. It's simply not the case. Too much has been ascribed to the Inca having created when the situation is far more complicated and covers a much greater timeline, more like 10,000 years rather than 800 years.
And what have you gathered about the older culture? What do you know about them?
Well, the strongest connection that I and others have is that it's known that the Inca came from Tiwanaku, which is on the southern shore of Lake Titicaca. And there we have the enigmatic places such as, Tiwanaku itself and also Puma Punku. And through different dating techniques, not the conventional ones, but using archaeoastronomy, for example, it's quite probable that the Tiwanaku Pumapunku area is or shows signs of having been initially constructed at least at 10 to 15,000 years ago. So since the Inca themselves came from that area, it's quite probable that they descended from the master megalithic builders who originally inhabited those two places.
Well, fascinating. And obviously the Incan are very much wrapped up in the conquistadors coming from Spain. What do you know about that?
Well, that's a very good point, because actually half of my book is about the interaction between the Spanish and the Inca, because what the question I started out with when I started writing my book was, how could 160 basically soldiers of fortune from Spain, none of these were really trained military people, how could 160 of them have taken over a civilization that had a standing army of 100,000? And so the story that I cover, it's about 60 to 70 pages in my book of the step-by-step process by which, the whole thing unfolded. The major thing that happened was that there was a civil war that occurred in or within the Inca civilization just prior to the arrival of the Spanish, and that was more or less the downfall of the Inca themselves, coupled with the fact that European diseases such as smallpox had arrived there about 10 years before, having been transmitted through the native population beginning in Panama, which was a major Spanish base, about 1510 to 1520. And it naturally moved through the moved south through the native population. By the time it hit what was the Inca civilization, it had destroyed probably a third to half of the population before the Spanish showed up.
Well, that's amazing. So, is that generally accepted as being the historical facts, or is that something that you've worked out for yourself?
I don't really know. For myself, it makes a lot of sense. The trouble is that all written history is subjective. So a lot of the Spanish chronicles are stilted towards the Spanish view. And the descendants of the Spanish who live here in Peru now are still, quite strongly, pro Spanish and pro conquistador. But the studies that are, or the chronicles that I've been analyzing the most, are those written by the few Inca descendants. The most famous one being Garcilaso de la Vega, who was half royal-blooded Inca, and I think his account is the most comprehensive and realistic.
And in terms of the spiritual side of things, what happened to the Incas that were in the spiritual awareness, the spiritual know? What happened to them? Where did they go? When the civilization fell into ruin and the conquistadors came, how did they protect, look after their real spiritual truths? What happened?
Well, that's a very good point, because in fact, the nature of the Inca civilization was the Sapa Inca, who was the highest official of royal bloodline. He was the equivalent of of a high chief. And so the difference between the European cultures and the native cultures is that someone who is a chief, doesn't stand on the top of the pyramid and is necessarily thought of as being a god. He is responsible for all of the people. So once Atahualpa, who was the last of the high Incas, was murdered by the Spanish, the entire civilization collapsed, because he was the pinnacle in terms of being the final decision maker. He wasn't like an overlord, but he was the one that everyone looked to make decisions as to what to do in terms of the military, spiritual aspects, and in terms of the government. Also, as a result of the civil war, Atahualpa, who was half-blooded Inca, murdered almost the entire Inca royal family about 6 months before the Spanish arrived. And so the few royal-blooded Inca who were able to escape, and that included the entire high class of priestly people, they either escaped into the jungles of the Amazon or up onto the almost very top of the sacred mountain called Ausangate outside of Cusco. And so all that seems to remain now of the strong spiritual authority or knowledge is amongst the, they're called the Karo people. And I think the problem is that a lot of people think the Karo are Inca. They're not. They seem to have been a priestly class of people, but they're very quite, or they're quite diminutive in size, whereas the Inca were quite tall people. So the Karo who still survive and are quite, you know, quite quiet and shy people, they are what's left of the spiritual legacy of the Inca.
Oh, okay. And Machu Picchu, did the conquistadors discover it?
No, Machu Picchu was one of two sacred cities that we know of that was never found by the conquistadors. The other one is called Choqueque Rao, which is equal in its grandeur. It's just, it's not as famous as Machu Picchu, and it's much harder to get to. But it's equal in terms of its grandeur. The whole story of Machu Picchu, you know, would be an interview within itself, because there are there are a lot of misconceptions about what it represented, what it stood for, and how it functioned. And unfortunately, that's it's another sad story. A lot of the guides at Machu Picchu are, you know, unfortunately, are not as well informed as they could be. And I'm not saying that from a viewpoint of my own arrogance. It's just that I've been studying this, you know, doggedly for 5 years, almost every day, and so you know. My education on Machu Picchu will never be complete, but every day I do learn something. It's a very significant site, but I also feel like it's kind of overemphasized. There are so many beautiful megalithic structures and places in Cusco and the Sacred Valley which are almost as fascinating as Machu Picchu, but people make this beeline to Machu Picchu and, you know, bypassing all the rest of these amazing places, such as especially Ollanta Tambo is one huge complex which the average tourist or visitor will spend like an hour or two at. And in the tours I give, we devote at least an entire 8-hour day to it.
So we'll come back to your tours after the break, but just in one, just in a very short word, why wouldn't they have found Machu Picchu? Why was it so hard to find?
Well, the very short story of Machu Picchu is that it was the equivalent of Camp David is to the U.S. president. So it was located outside of Cusco on purpose because it was a place, as the Inca civilization grew, you know, to become huge, basically, it was it covered from the southern part of Colombia down south to about the middle section of Chile, west to the Pacific Ocean, and east into the Amazon. And so once it became that kind of size, the spiritual people, the government people, and the military people needed a central location in order to be able to discuss, you know, sensitive affairs of state without the general public, you know, sticking their noses in. So Machu Picchu was...
Brian, we actually are coming up to our break, so we'll just continue finishing this fascinating discussion after our next break. It's Peter Tung for Awakening to Conscious Co-Creation.
What's happening on the Voice America Talk Radio Network by keeping up with us on Twitter. You can find us at Voice America TRN.
Do you want to reach your highest potential in your personal and business life? Come and join our heart-centered community with Peter Tung and Sherry Chase. Embrace love, abundance, integrity, and personal empowerment in a safe and sacred space for your awakening. Our intention is to lay the groundwork for you to advance your awareness efficiently, to be fully involved in the conscious co-creation of peace and prosperity on our beautiful planet. Go to myheartcenteredjourney.com for more information.
To perform at your maximum potential, you need to have all aspects of your life working properly. On Mind, Brain, and Body, Dr. Michael John Kell will bring you honest, open discussions concerning your physical, mental, and financial health. If you're ready to find purpose and meaning in your life, tune in to Mind, Brain, and Body every Friday at 8 a.m. Pacific. Mind, Brain, and Body on Voice America Health and Wellness. Radio dedicated to your health, wealth, wisdom, and purpose. Listening on a higher dimension. Seventh Wave Network.
You're listening to Awakening to Conscious Co-Creation with Peter Tong. If you have a question for Peter or comment on this series, please send an email to descendingdove@gmail.com. That's descendingdove@gmail.com. Now back to our program.
Welcome back to Awakening to Conscious Co-Creation with your host, Peter Tong. Just before the break, Brian Forster was talking to us about Machu Picchu and its significance as the civilization in the area grew so tremendously. So just continue about Machu Picchu, Brian.
Okay, well, I think the important thing again is that Machu Picchu was more or less the equivalent of Camp David. It was a very highly secure place where affairs of state could be discussed in terms of the military, the religious people, the government, etc. Far enough away from Cusco, and the climate at Machu Picchu, because it's about 2,500 feet lower than Cusco, is much gentler and nicer. So it was a combination of a sort of spa rest place, as well as being the major conference center. There are only two trails that access Machu Picchu, and so that way it was easy for the security forces to be able to make sure that no one could enter while the affairs of state were being discussed. The reason why it escaped the Spanish was simply because it was so isolated, and is to this present day. Most people, when they get off the train, they think automatically they'll see Machu Picchu in the distance, but it's about a 25-minute, quite harrowing bus ride up hairpin turns to get to the point where you actually see the location of it, which is a majestic tour by itself.
Wow. Interesting. So you lead these sacred site tours yourself in the area of Cusco, and you mentioned the Sacred Valley. So you obviously are an expert, and so you know the local lay of the land and the key places to go to. So just tell our listeners a little bit about the trips that you lead.
Well, there are a number of different ones. Usually we start, I usually do 4 to 7 day ones, but on occasion I'll do like a single day tour. We normally start with a tour of Inca Cusco itself, and so we walk through the streets of Cusco, and I point out the megalithic buildings, which were either built by the Inca, but the majority of them were built before Inca times. And then after that, we do a tour of 1 or 2 days within the Sacred Valley to places like Pizac and Ollantay Tambo, which again were occupied by the Inca, but were constructed in some cases up to 10,000 or 12,000 years ago initially. And then after that, Machu Picchu, of course, is a 1 or 2 day trip. We also go down towards the area of Lake Titicaca to go to Pumapunku and Tiwanaku, as well as Nazca, and my present fascination, which is the Paracas area just south of Lima by about 4 hours by bus, and that's where the elongated skull people are. But the emphasis that my wife and I give, and those that work with us, is that we give you the entire history of Cusco and the Sacred Valley. Most tour companies will talk about the Inca period, which started about 1200 AD, but we go back in time, as I said, at least 10,000 or 20,000, or in some cases 20,000 years, which, of course, the archaeologists don't want to hear about. But every single tour that we give is a research opportunity for me. And on each trip, I learn something more about the megalithic nature and a little bit more about the megalithic builders, who were, simply amazing in terms of what they were able to achieve.
What was in terms of the megalithic structures, what was the main reason for creating those structures?
That question, at this point, I honestly can't answer. It's my study is more about how they could possibly have achieved it, because, again, a lot of the tour guides will say that the Inca had slaves, and so, the 120-ton... andesite blocks were, dragged from the quarries by these, chains of 10 or, 2 or 3 or 10,000 people, which is, you know, quite ridiculous. It seems obviously that, you know, some form of what we call magic was involved, in that the megalithic builders had an incredibly powerful sense of the nature of not simply the nature of reality, but the nature of the physical laws. And so they were able to in some way neutralize gravity and push these stones not along the ground, but probably slightly levitated above the ground, as if they were styrofoam blocks. And this is, you know, this isn't backed up at this point by science, but it's backed up by the oral traditions who say that. They say that the high priest would chant at a specific stone, and that a whole group of other priests again would join in, and by doing that, the stone itself would literally rise off the ground, and then the workers could simply push it as it floated perhaps a foot or two off the ground, and move these stones into place again as if they were styrofoam. That's something that the Inca couldn't do, and the Inca stated that to the early Spanish. Especially when Sacsayhuaman, which is where these 120-ton blocks are, which is a so-called fortress above Cusco, the Spanish were shocked by what they saw because they had seen nothing in Europe on that scale. And so they said, "Did you build this?" And the Inca always said, "No." The same thing with Tiwanaku. When the Spanish first went there, they asked the local people and the Inca who were there, "Did you build this?" And the Inca always said no. But unfortunately, in the modern tourist industry, I'm not trying to bash all the guides, but unfortunately, too many of them say the Inca did it, and they were supermen. And if the Inca themselves said they didn't build it, then that's proof enough for me.
Absolutely. Isn't it fascinating, though, this technology existed in South America as well as Egypt and South Africa, places around the world we still don't know the technology, but clearly sound, frequency, and intention is a part of it.
Exactly. And it seems, people talk about, technology in terms of high technology. It could have simply been the ability of these people to, to understand the concept of, the physical laws so well that they had natural ways of bypassing that which we find impossible without tools. And that's what's, that's what's quite amazing. I do know, some of the listeners might know Christopher Dunn, who wrote a great couple of books. One of them is called The Giza Power Plant. And Chris is a no-nonsense engineer, being that he, anything that he studies, whether it's in Egypt, at the pyramids, for example, or at Pumapunku, he studies them as an engineer does. And so I've been able to ask him personally questions about how he thinks some of these things were achieved. And he states quite plainly that these ancient people, he'll never give a timeline, but again, we're working with more or less around the time of the so-called, flood, as in the Ice Age, end of the Ice Age period. And he simply states these people must have had technology of some kind, not exactly what we have, but something akin to that, in order to achieve, these absolutely astonishing works. They could not have used the Inca tools which were at hand, which were bronze chisels and stone hammers.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's move on, because we need to spend some time chatting about your latest project, the elongated skulls. Just fill us in on that one.
Okay, well, actually, my interest in that began, when I was writing my first book about the Inca, A Brief History of the Incas, because at the Coricancha, which was the spiritual center of Cusco, and therefore the spiritual center of the entire Inca civilization, there's a tiny museum in the basement, and there on display were these four elongated, conehead-type skulls, which had labels that stated Inca on them. And so I thought, well, that's strange, because I had seen photographs from the Tiwanaku Museum and also the major museum in La Paz, which is the capital of Bolivia, of skull samples that were taken from Tiwanaku and Pumapunku, and they as well had these elongated skulls. So I thought, well, if the Inca, in fact, came from Tiwanaku, then genetically the skulls that are on display at Tiwanaku and La Paz are probably... They're either their relatives indirectly are their ancestors directly. And so I thought, well, this is starting to get into the idea that the Inca were, as the chronicles say, a physically different kind of human being than the local population. Because what is known about the Inca was that it was a royal priestly family. Inca does not refer to every citizen. It refers to a very small group of people. At the absolute maximum, there were possibly 1,000 of them amongst a population at the height of the civilization of probably 12 million. So they were a royal bloodline that only bred within, you know, within their family. And so the elongated skull thing I thought was, you know, was quite interesting. And the more research that I've been doing is that the other area of Peru where you find this phenomenon of the elongated skull is, again, this area called Paracas, which is 4 hours south of Lima by bus. And that's where you find skulls which are astonishingly large, as in, you know, head binding is what most people say was what was responsible for this malshaping or altering of the shape of the skull. But I've seen examples at the Ica Museum, which is close to Paracas, where the cranial volume of the skull would be between 2 and 2.5 times that of an average human being. And so that starts to suggest that what we're looking at is not necessarily what we call human. And I've been able to find at least 5 major physical characteristics within these skulls that are very abnormal in terms of they're not what you would commonly find in a human skull, whether it's in Africa or, you know, Asia or North America or Europe.
So, Brian, we're coming up to our final break, so let's come back with that topic on our return about these 5 characteristics of the elongated skulls. Peter Tung here for Awakening to Conscious Co-Creation.
Think you've seen everything there is to see in online television? Let us surprise you. Visit voiceamerica.tv today for sports, health, business, and more on demand 24/7.
Do you want to reach your highest potential in your personal and business life? Come and join our heart-centered community with Peter Tung and Sherry Chase. Embrace love, abundance, integrity, and personal empowerment in a safe and sacred space for your awakening. Our intention is to lay the groundwork for you to advance your awareness efficiently, to be fully involved in the conscious co-creation of peace and prosperity on our beautiful planet. Go to myheartcenteredjourney.com for more information.
Do you need directions to solid financial future? If so, the Money Answer Show with Jordan Goodman will provide you with a roadmap to making smart money decisions in every area of your personal finances. Join Jordan every Monday at 12 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, 3 p.m. Eastern, for the Money Answer Show on the Voice America Business Channel. Learn how and where to get the best deals on mortgages, cars, and insurance. Find out the best ways to save for college and retirement. Get out of debt, improve your credit rating, and save on your taxes. The Money Answer Show with Jordan Goodman will provide you with great tips on investment opportunities in real estate, stocks, annuities, and other investment vehicles. That's the Money Answer Show with Jordan Goodman on the Voice America Business Channel every Monday at 12 p.m. Pacific Standard Time.
Be extraordinary. Seventh Wave Network.
You're listening to Awakening to Conscious Co-Creation with Peter Tung. If you have a question for Peter or comment on this series, please send an email to descendingdove@gmail.com. That's descendingdove@gmail.com. Now back to our program.
Welcome back to Awakening to Conscious Co-Creation. I'm your host, Peter Tung, having a fascinating discussion today with Brian Forster. Before we go back to the elongated skulls, Brian, just give us your websites and information that people can contact you if they want to go on a trip with you or gather more information from your work.
Sure. My main website is hiddenincatours.com. That's all one word. And that is not... that is my main website. It's that's where you can contact me through through email. It's also quite a major resource website. It's not simply a tour website, but I have links to 490 YouTube videos that I've made so far, a lot of photographs and all sorts of things like that. So it's a resource for, you know, for travelers beyond simply being a tour site. I'm also on Facebook. It's Brian Forster, BrienForster. And if you want to look up my YouTube videos independent of my website, it's Brian Forster, all one word.
Okay, great. And you've got a major event coming up around the 11-11-11 in November, do you not?
Oh, yes, that's true, with Megalithomania from England. Hugh Newman, who is in charge of Megalithomania, will be traveling with me, and also David Hatcher Childress, the famous author who I am presently co-authoring a book with. The three of us will be guiding a tour from the 10th until the 20th of November, starting at Lake Titicaca and looking at all of the major megalithic sites there and in Cusco and the Sacred Valley, including, of course, a trip to Machu Picchu. And after that, there'll be a four-day extension for those people who wish to go to the Nazca area and see the Nazca lines, as well as the elongated skulls of the Paracas culture as well.
Sounds like a pretty amazing opportunity, and there's an outside chance I may actually meet you there, Brian.
That'd be great, Peter.
So you just mentioned David Hatcher Childress, and he's involved with you in writing this book about the elongated skull. So let's go back to that and just tell us, you were talking about these five characteristics that are different from a typical human skull.
Okay, well, the main thing, you know, people will have to visualize a little bit here, but with your skull or any skull you find of any living human being on Earth, there's one characteristic which is very specific, and that's there are three major cranial plates that make up your skull. There's what's called the frontal plate, which is where your forehead is, and then behind that there are two plates called the parietal plates, and they form almost like a T shape in terms of these suture lines that connect the three together. And in a baby, it's these three plates that that grow and then eventually form together, creating the normal shape of a skull. And that's where the deformation has been done culturally in Africa, on the island of Malta, in Iraq, Melanesia, and Peru, creating this elongated shape. But I found examples in Peru, specifically in the Paracas area, where these there are skulls that only have two plates. They have one parietal and one frontal plate. And researchers such as Lloyd Pye, that I'm in contact with, who is the caretaker of the Starchild skull, he said that can't be a human characteristic. Other things are the fact that a number of these skulls do not show signs of having molars, not even the pits where the molar, you know, teeth would fit, which is strange because these people would have lived on a very heavy diet of corn, and so you need the molars to grind, you know, grind the corn, but that is something lacking. Another thing is the jaws are very, you know, much larger than a normal human being, and there are two holes in the back of the head, which Lloyd Pye has stated he believes that that's where nerve endings and blood vessels would come out in order for the body to be able to, you know, feed the, you know, the fact that the skull is much larger than normal, that that's something nature would have done in order to provide nutrition and nerve sensitivity to that part of the skull. So again, that shows that there's some kind of natural evolutionary aspect to this rather than simply being a ceremonial thing that was done.
And you're currently involved in some DNA testing, aren't you, in this work?
Exactly. Lloyd has 10 samples of DNA that I sent to him from five different skulls, And I actually come from a scientific background. I have a bachelor's degree from UVic, as in University of Victoria.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, that's been lying dormant for quite a long time. But as soon as the, we started to get into this idea of having, DNA sampling done, my scientific mind turned back on, and I was quite rigorous in terms of the sampling and making sure that everything was sterile, everything was labeled, and making sure that I took at least two samples from each skull in order that we have a broad base once the evidence comes in that that it can't be said that one is, if one is anomalous, then of course we don't have a scientific result. But I was able to take skin samples, hair samples, a tooth sample, and some bone containing marrow so that we can access the mitochondrial DNA from them.
And so what are you hoping to understand and learn from the results of the DNA?
Well, again, trying to be scientific in mind, I have no preconceptions or no ideas right now because the ramifications could be quite bizarre. So I'm simply waiting. We're hoping to start to get some results within a month, and then by October we should have quite a good idea. If need be, I do have other samples, and what I'm going to be doing is taking samples from other elongated skulls as they, come into my life in order to build up as strong a body of evidence as we can. The implications could be quite intriguing. Lloyd Pye and others are talking about the possibility that these are hybrid humans as in evidence of off-world, so-called genetic input. But I'm not going to go there right now because it's just too, I don't want to, wind up saying something and then, be called an idiot in a couple of months. I'd rather say no opinion, and then if it turns out to be fascinating, I'll say, well, there it is.
Yeah. But you obviously must have considered the connection with Egypt and Akhenaten in that time period.
Exactly, but if you know Stephen Mailer, who's an independent Egyptologist and a very intelligent man, he has, he's physically seen Tutankhamun's skull, for example, and other members of the Amarna family, who, Akhenaten was and Tutankhamun were members of the what's called the Amarna family Amarna family, and he said that there's nothing he could see that shows that the skulls are larger than normal. He said they're of a different shape as an elongated, but the cranial capacity doesn't look like it's much more massive than conventional humans are, whereas the Paracas ones, as far as I can tell so far, are the only examples we have in the world that are, again, they have cranial capacity of 2 to 2.5 that of a normal human being.
And you're actually going to be moving there shortly to take up a new position in Paracas.
Yeah, that's true. I've been given the title of assistant museum director, and so my wife and I are in the process of building a house in Paracas, and it'll be great because right now we're living in Lima, which is a city of 10 million, and I'm not much of an urbanite, so it'll be a lot nicer to live in a little seaside town like that and still be close enough to Nazca and Cusco and Tiwanaku. And even the Lima International Airport to be able to maneuver quite well.
Now, you were talking about potentially having a book out earlier with David Hatcher Childress. Is that still scheduled for this year?
It is. We're hoping for October. David and I have broken it up into chapters. We're each going to be doing about 50%, and it's going to be an analysis of the elongated skull phenomenon around the world, including, of course, the Amarna in Egypt, other groups in Africa, Malta, northern Iraq, Melanesia, and Peru, and a few other areas. And then after that, I'm planning on writing my own book specifically about the Paracas people and their possible connections with other parts of the Pacific, because Paracas is right on the Pacific Ocean, and I'm a very strong believer in the concept that ancient human beings, several thousand years ago, were very easily able to travel across not only the Atlantic but the Pacific. I see no reason why conventional academics say that, you know, that it was impossible for them to do, you know, for them to build ships and understand the concept of sailing, because that's something I learned about in my time in Polynesia, that the concept of celestial navigation is not as complicated as some people would have you believe. So why, you know, why couldn't someone 10,000 years ago build a boat, have a sail, and travel even from Africa to North America?
Yeah. We're coming up to the end of the show, Brian. It's been a really fascinating journey. Can you just give us 30 seconds on the Nazca lines and what you think they are?
Yeah, the latest evidence I found about Nazca is that it's divided into two timelines. You have the lines, of course, and then you also have the animal figures. What seems to be the case is that the Paracas people were the makers of the animal figures. That could only have been done from the sky, whether by balloon or by, you know, flying saucer, who knows. But the lines themselves came later. Really obvious evidence of that is the fact that the famous spider figure, if you look at any picture, you'll see that lines are carved straight through it, as if the builders of the lines, who were the Nazca people, did that without even being conscious of the fact that they were, you know, traversing across the animals. The lines themselves can be made from the ground. You can see them from the ground, because I was there a month or two ago and I could see that. The animal figures can't be seen from the ground. Just in closing, the lines themselves probably were made to follow aquifer systems, water systems underneath the ground, not made by aliens.
Okay. Well, Brian, it's been an absolutely fascinating time spent with you. It's gone really quickly. I really appreciate your time, and good luck with the DNA samples for the elongated skulls.
Well, thank you very much, Peter, and I hope you can join Hugh Newman and David Childress and myself in November and explore the megaliths of